Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be discussing three equities in some detail, as we do on this weekly instalment of the UK Investor Magazine podcast. And to do that, we're joined once more by Alan Green. Alan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Jonathan. Good to be back.
So, as I mentioned, we have three equities that we're going to go through. But Alan, before we get into those, I think it would be appropriate to touch on Bitcoin. It was a market, an asset that we were discussing on a regular basis at the beginning of this year, when we were seeing quite sharp moves to the upside and looking at the reasoning behind that and what the market forces were. Now that we're seeing Bitcoin yesterday crash through 30,000 for the first time since early this year, it would, of course, be beneficial, I think, to go back to Bitcoin and have a look at what's happening there. So, One of the main drivers, of course, there's lots of factors at play with cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. Elon Musk being one of those, other hedge funds being involved and making comments can move the market as well. But this time around, Alan, it's very much a market that's being driven by the actions of China. They've moved to curb its use. They've told certain payment systems such as Alipay to stop using it. They've put out some pretty stark messages that anybody seen to be flouting their new guidance will be punished severely. Alan, in your view, is Bitcoin doomed to fail if it doesn't have the backing and support of China?
Well, I think this is, frankly, it's a cynical move by governments. China's obviously made the first move, but we had India a while ago to curb the use of cryptocurrencies in general. I mean, the one thing is, of course, it's well established that being a decentralized finance system, it's a haven for criminals and other organizations. Other unsavory organizations to move money around, but equally, a lot of people will take the view that the centralized finance systems are skewed in favor of the operators. So no one really, there isn't really a fair and unbiased system out there. If there is one, I think the crypto finance marketplace is the best of the lot. But I don't believe China can curb it all it likes, but I think cryptocurrency is here to stay. Bitcoin's here to stay, and we've seen these growing pains before. We've seen we saw India ban the use of cryptocurrency or cryptocurrencies a year or so ago, and there have been issues all the way through, and there will continue to be issues. But the fact is, cryptocurrency now is a massive marketplace. We've seen the emergence of NFTs. Of course, I've spoken about companies like Coincilium here beforehand, which is involved in producing the next generation marketplace for non-fungible tokens. Make no mistake about it, this is vast and it's huge, and governments and organizations are getting involved at various levels, basically involving the blockchain. So I think what we'll see is a process of evolution. We'll see the coins evolve. We're seeing all these new coins coming to market and rushing up to crazy valuations. So I view this as nothing more than a correction in the evolution of cryptocurrency.
So when we're talking about cryptocurrency there, you of course mentioned blockchain. I mean, what would you say to a view that really that the most important technology here is blockchain, and cryptocurrencies were just the early facilitator, product asset that was used by blockchain and the blockchain technology? And really, over time, I mean, over the last 15 years since Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies started, we haven't really seen it being integrated into mainstream finance. Of course, it is being adopted more widely there, but the notion of replacing certain fiat currencies is still way off. So, I mean, is it really that Bitcoin was the first major project there to work on the blockchain? And of course, everybody has jumped on it and there's been a big hype around it. But do you think going forward that now people have realized, okay, yes, that's done, and they're going to start to focus more on the underlying blockchain technology more?
Well, I think what tends to happen when you get a new bubble emerging or a new marketplace emerging, there are always one or two key players that emerge and continue to represent that sector. And I think Bitcoin was the original. That was it. You know, everyone's all the fans of cryptocurrency celebrate Bitcoin Pizza Day, which of course is when the first pizza ever was ordered, I think back in 2013, and it's celebrated every year. So that kind of, marked the emergence into the consciousness of the general public of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is still the biggest brand out there by a mile. Of course, Ethereum is a close second to that, but I think it's a step along the way. Cryptocurrencies are here to stay. I think there was an article in one of the well-regarded UK publications about GovCoin, about governments wanting to get involved and utilize the blockchain process as a means of as an alternative finance system. And this is just one more step along the road. We've of course spoken about non-fungible tokens, John, and looked at the ramifications of that and how that's evolving as a marketplace. But there are so many other potential applications for the blockchain that I believe it's just a step along the road. But despite the crash in the Bitcoin valuation, it is, in my view, another correction, and we will see a floor put down in terms of the valuation, and then we'll move on from here.
Indeed. I mean, looking at the price of Bitcoin today, of course, there has been some buyers stepping in. It's up probably around sort of 34,000 from lows, underneath 30,000 yesterday. So obviously some people seeing some value there. So it's going to be interesting to see how this pans out as things progresses. And I'm sure something that we will touch on the podcast again. So let's move on now, Alan, to our three equities. And the first company of which operating in somewhat a more tangible market than Bitcoin in Barclay Group Homes. They have reported today quite good results on the face of it, Alan, but shares are a little bit soggy today, down about 1% currently. What's been happening there?
Well, I think Barclay Group, as you rightly say, it's and we've spoken so many times beforehand about expectations in the market, and often it's better to travel than to arrive in stock market parlance. But I mean, Barclay Group have put in a great result, you know, and this is from a period covering COVID year. So yeah, you know, full year results show profit of 518 million. That's up from 500 million or 503 million last time. The group said it was its profits were driven by the sale of properties that it had built worth more than 700,000. So that's well above, of course, the UK housing average. So high value homes have driven profits, and that could well be on the back of moves by people who were in the city, fleeing to the countryside to avoid the worst ramifications of the COVID lockdown. Barclays sold 2,800 homes in London, the southeast, and that average selling price was 770,000. So I think we can see clearly why. And of course, I think the question mark now is: will people continue to flee the city? And I think they probably will, actually. I think that trend will continue for some time to come. I know living here in Seaford on the south coast, we've seen prices here go crazy over the past the past year to 18 months, and you know, people are just moving in, and homes come on the market and they get snapped up almost straight away. So I mean that looks set to come, that looks set to continue. But also the company in its outlook said it saw a recovery in the capital once COVID restrictions have been lifted. And of course, there's a lot of commercial property in London too, which the landlords of those properties will have taken a battering over the past year, because a lot of companies are unable to pay their rent or are considering moving out altogether. So those are issues for the company to consider. And indeed, there are issues. Barclays Group has a very strong balance sheet and a strong order book. It's got over a billion of cash in the bank, so I think it's pretty secure and well positioned. But the London market I think will recover at some point, and Barclays does have a large exposure to that. So I would look at any sort of sell-off in the share price as an opportunity here. Certainly a very good chart over the past year. I mean, we're seeing shares have traded just under £50 on a year high and just under £40 on a year low. And here we are almost exactly halfway between the two. So a steady chart there as well. A good charting performance. And of course, you get a dividend yield of 2.5% to boot. So what's not to like?
Yes, fairly strong dividend there. I mean, Alan, when you're looking at Barclays Group and the rest of the house builders, I mean, how much do you feel at this point in time that maybe the timing of this release is one of the reasons why we're seeing a bit of a dip down in shares? Not so much because of what's happening there with the company, but looking at the wider market, just in the last few days, we've had some comments from Rightmove that we're starting to see the first stages of a slowdown in the housing market. House prices in June rose just 0.8% versus 1.8% in May. So obviously things starting to cool off there. Of course, we're coming to the end of the stamp duty break, and we're starting to see possibly some more stock coming onto the housing market. Do you think that there's an element of investors looking at Barclays Group and the rest of the house builders and thinking, well, you've had excellent conditions for the last year. We can't see those conditions being replicated and being as favourable for you going forward over the next 18 to 24 months?
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think the thing is property sales in London and the South East is very, very strong. But as the COVID restrictions are lifted and city living, city properties once again become more attractive, then that market will open up. I mean, we could argue that market's had a hiatus for the past year to 18 months. So it's overdue a recovery. Given Barclays' focus in London and the South East, where properties are at a premium, there's a shortage of decent housing. I know through our own experience, we've got my daughter and her husband have had an offer accepted on the house, but the sellers are in a chain and they just can't find a property to buy. I mean, there is a real shortage of housing at the moment, so there is an issue here. And I think all the while there's a shortage in supply, companies like Barclays Group, particularly with its focus in London and the South East, will continue to clean up.
Indeed. It's going to be interesting to see how the UK housing market develops through the rest of 2021, and one that we will be discussing again, I'm sure, on the podcast. So let's move on now, Alan. So this is a company that I don't believe that we've discussed on the podcast previously. We're certainly not within the last 18 months. Altona Rare Earths. It's operating in Africa as well as, let's have a look here, I think it's just mainly Africa, isn't it, Alan?
Yeah, that's right, John. Africa.
So there's been a lot, from what I can see here in my notes, happening there. What were the main takeaways from that, Alan?
Okay, John, so Alterna Rare Earths is, the epicode is ANR. It's an Aquis listed company at the moment. Shares are currently trading at 10.5p, giving it a market cap of just over 2 million, which is, you know, given where, you know, mining and exploration companies are, and particularly companies engaged in powering the new technologies such as clean energy, electric vehicles, batteries, new generation batteries, and so on. It really just values the value of the entity and nothing more. Formerly, Alterna was had some coal assets which were sold off last year, at the start of the year, it reported its year-end results, a loss before tax of $228,000 coming from those historic coal asset impairments. And throughout the year, it's undergone a series of fundraisings, $500,000 at the start of the year, and then it's raised several more chunks since then. Most recently, $180,000 was raised at the end of last week. So the company has set out its stall now. It's engaged in rare earths, as the name would imply, and it is in the process of assessing and going through the process of due diligence, which, as the company CEO Christian Taylor Wilkinson has said, is taking time, and it's taking time because they have a very exacting process, and they want to ensure that all of the boxes are ticked before they actually make the move and acquire those assets. To that end, they are looking at assets in Mozambique, in Uganda, and also in Malawi. So the three on the table here. And to that end, they've engaged legal teams in each of those jurisdictions to help finalize this due diligence process. So the first one is Monte Muambi Rare Earth Project and the Tete province in northwestern Mozambique. Now, also on the board is Audrey Matupi, who's CEO of System Logic Business in Africa. She's very well known in her field and is on the boards of many other companies in that area. And Cedric Simone, who is non-exec director and geologist, also worked for Sedrum Fluorspar and is on the Kenya Chamber of Mining. So the Monte Muambi project is based on a former fluorspar mine, which Cedric Simone has been involved in, and historically has had 165 drill holes drilled at the project, intersecting rare earth elements in at least four of those holes. And there is an asset there that's been established. Total rare earth assets there have been assessed at about 2.5% of the samples that were taken. And in regard to progress with this asset, the company is undertaking historic analysis of the historic samples prior to the final decision. And we expect to hear about that in the next few weeks. The company has said it expects to own and finalize all three assets by the end of quarter two, which of course is in a few weeks' time. So that's why we're at a very exciting juncture for the company. The second one is in Uganda, the Nankoma Rare Earth Project, which is 130 kilometers east of Kampala in eastern Uganda. The issue here is that there is a staged acquisition process undergoing a series of due diligence milestones, which the company currently undertaking, this is progressing. Soil samples again taken, and geologist Gavin Beer, who works exclusively for Alterna, is overseeing the assay the assay results prior to the final decision, which we expect to hear about very shortly. We also, with the at the Nankoma project, there is a project called the Makutu project nearby, which is owned and operated by ASX listed Ionic Rare Earths. They have established a mineral resource estimate of 300 million tons at 650 parts per million total rare earth oxides, and these include some of the key rare earths for use in military, green technology and battery technology, and some of the geological anomalies from Makutu run through the Nankoma rare earth territory. So again, we're very close to finalising that one. Third one is the Chambray asset in the southern Malawi, and this is owned by a company called Akatswiri. And again, a staged proposal is on the table here. However, they are waiting for Akatswiri to confirm the Malawian government has approved its exploration license ahead of signing this agreement, and that is expected to come in any day now. Interesting to see as well that a couple of private investors, Paul and Catherine McKillen, own 6.7% now, having owned 4.5% previously. And also last week, at the end of May, there's a resource investor based in, it's got offices in London, Johannesburg and Perth, Mayflower Group, increased its holding from 14.5% to 29.5%, just under the level at which it's it will be forced to launch a bid for the group. So, so this is the company is poised, I think, to deliver a complete re-rating in terms of its valuation, and that will, I believe, be catalysed by the imminent move by the company from Aquis onto the London main market. And as soon as that happens, I think value will out, because obviously the shares will be exposed to a wider range of investors who will be able to trade and buy electronically. So a very exciting company, minuscule valuation given the size of the assets. Once those assets, of course, are in its own ownership, then I think we're going to see this company make significant progress going forward.
Yeah, certainly sounds like an interesting portfolio of assets that they're working on there. But Alan, when you're looking at the company, you mentioned there the minuscule valuation. Why do you think the market is attributing such a small valuation to this company at the moment? I mean, looking at it, there could be, on the surface, they don't have any operations currently, so therefore revenue is going to be a hell of a long way off, potentially. There is also this element of them having to raise further capital and, the uncertainty around that. I mean, which one of those two, or indeed, is there anything else that you think is holding these shares back at the moment?
Well, I think also I mentioned at the start that the company has these legacy assets, the coal assets. So there will be investors still holding the stock that have an interest there. And we've seen the share price sort of pop up here and there. And when that happens, of course, the a lot of investors may not want to be involved in rare earths, so they'll sell off. So there probably is some ongoing selling pressure there. But interesting to note that the price last week was 9p, and the fundraising that was announced on Friday was at 12p. So so that's really, I think, shows that investors into the company, institutional investors, do value this very highly. And it's interesting that the Mayflower Group have such a high stake in the business. So be interesting to see what happens with that once we get launched onto the main market.
Indeed. I mean, anytime you see a company able to secure a placing at a higher price than recent trade is a positive sign. So it can be interesting to see how things develop at Altona. I'm sure we'll discuss that one again on the podcast. So let's move on now, Alan, to our final company of the day. Now, this is one, indeed, we have touched on numerous occasions on the podcast due to its strong news flow and the developments that's happening there at the company. The company is Mosman Oil and Gas. And, of course, Alan, we probably said on the podcast last time. Do keep an eye out for the news flow that's coming through from them. And indeed, looking here at the list of RNS since the last time we discussed them, there has been a steady and quite comprehensive list of updates there from Mosman. So what do they look like?
Okay, so this is a company with a really strong spread of assets. It's the principal revenue producing assets are its oil assets. It has a series of we have spoken, of course, previously about companies with small oil wells that produce and can do so at a low cost. And Mosman is one of those companies. So the company currently is trading at 0.18p. It's up 36% on the year, giving a market cap of just 6.5 million. You know, which is I think considering the quality of the assets it has here is almost irrisory, really. But we've seen a year of 0.28, a year high of 0.28p, and a year low of just under 0.1p. So 0.18p, it's certainly some way off year highs. Companies run by Executive Chairman John Barr, formerly Aquarius Platinum, Thor Mining, and TNG. Andy Carroll is the technology director. They have a series of assets in East Texas, and this is the Falcon 1 asset, oil well, the Cinnabar asset, the Galaxy asset, and then Stanley and Greater Stanley. Over the past few months, there have been some production issues with Falcon 1 that have been resolved, and the well is now back to production. But the company has taken a big step forward today by announcing effectively what is an immediate boost to its oil production following the acquisition of producing assets in East Texas. Now, the company already had a 15% stake in the Stanley project. That's now jumped to 35% to 39%. We're also seeing a production jump to over twice the level. Production is up from 27 barrels of oil per day to 60 barrels of oil per day. And the company's also acquired working interest in two other leases, the Livingston lease and the Winters lease, 20%, 23% respectively. And that will, between them to start with, they will produce 7 barrels of oil per day. But at Winters, there is another development well that is shortly to be underway, along with another well at Falcon 2. So production is set to exponentially increase. Mosman acquired this by using their own cash generated from a recent placing and also from income from its oil sales. Acquired NADS Oil Co. LLC outright for $1.1 million, as I say, it immediately drives revenues to the bottom line. But it also means that all three leases, the Stanley lease, the Livingston and Winters lease, Mosman is now the operator of the lease, which gives it way more control on a day-to-day basis. So that's if you like the cash generator for the company going forward, and it is driving the revenues to the bottom line. Then on the other side, we have and also the other side of the world, we have the Amadeus Basin interest in the Northern Territories in Australia, and here we have quite a unique opportunity to drill for helium. There's a big helium asset in the ground at EP145. It's an environmentally sensitive area, and all the permissions are in place. And we're going to see this progress as we go forward. A note was published recently on the potential for the Amadeus asset, the broker believes the asset is unrisked, worth $172 million Australian dollars at present. So as this comes into production, it could literally treble Mosman's current market worth. So it's actually a really good business model. They've got cash from cash revenues coming in from the oil production that's bringing money into the bank every month, and then the Blue Sky asset here, which has huge potential, which of course they will develop going forward. Great team, as I've already mentioned, John Barr, Andy Carroll, and also the geologist John Young, who's with them, non-exec director also, with 25 years experience. He's worked with Banix Gold previously and Trek Metals. And I think, going forward, we've got a really exciting opportunity for the company to both increase its production in East Texas, and any further developments at EP145 Amadeus in Australia are going to see this go through the roof.
So, Alan, we obviously touched on the production there. Now, I was reading a report the other day from an analyst, and I mean, there were predictions there from him that we could see $100 oil in the next 2 years. Of course, that comes with a significant grain of salt. I mean, if we did see that, I mean, how strong is the production at Mosman, that if we did see a higher level of prices in oil, I mean, is that enough to get the share price moving by itself? Or do you feel that we really need to see some progress and some real results from these development projects that they're working on to start to see a bit of excitement and life coming back into the share price and see those higher valuations?
Well, I think as I said at the start, the where they're operating, the cost to drill wells and get wells on stream is relatively low. So already we've got production, with today's announcement up at about 110 barrels of oil per day. But that's going to be boosted hugely in the not too distant future by another well at the Falcon asset, and also another well at the Stanley asset. In addition to which, of course, we also have the Cinnabar asset and the Galaxy asset as well, all of which will be coming on stream at some point shortly. So if the oil price holds as strong as it is at the moment, just through its own activities, which are all fully funded, we're going to see Mosman increase oil production exponentially. And of course, if there is a jump in the oil price up to $100 per barrel, then we're going to see exponential growth in Mosman oil price too. So you've got those drivers. And then, as I say, the Blue Sky driver is the EP145 asset, because helium is a gas that there's a real shortage of. Australia is one of the bigger producers in the world. And of course, helium has applications in medical, nuclear and space technologies. And demand currently significantly exceeds current production. So there's a real demand for this. And if this asset can be brought on stream quickly, as the broker said, it could treble Mosman's current market cap pretty easily.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Alan. So just a recap there on the shares that we discussed today. At the beginning was Barclay Group Holdings, trading under the ticker of BKG. It was then Altona Rare Earth, trading under the ticker of ANR. And just then was Mosman Oil and Gas, which trades under the ticker of MSMN. Alan, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Thanks again, John.
So just a heads up to listeners, we do have another podcast being released later on this week, an interview we did with the Chief Investment Officer of GXO, which is being spun out of XPO Logistics, which is listed over in the United States. It has about a $16 billion market cap, one of the biggest players in logistics in the world. So do check that out, because we're going to be discussing a number of things, including the automation, and robotics of logistics. So very interesting, and do give it a listen. Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.